Hello, this is the Laughing Satirist back with Memories of a Family Vacation, a satire of a disappointing inheritance, family values, resort shopping, time travel, and influence shopping with the Department of Defense. The story raises the important but largely neglected question of how family memories are passed from one generation to another, particularly when the recipient is an in-law. Memories of a Family Vacation. I didn't want to go to the lake again. It was Lillian's idea. Her family has a place beside the bay. For them it held wonderful memories, how their grandfather won it in a poker game, the drives up from Chicago in the 50s, freighters passing through the sinking sun on the horizon. For me, it brought flashbacks to our honeymoon, a hellish week when the septic tank overflowed daily and we only had Lillian's cooking to tide us through. Worst were her father's monologues about the Second World War, where he acted out his hatred for the human race as second in command of a destroyer. Night after night, inflamed by bourbon and darkness, he gathered the family around him on the huge porch overlooking the bay. As children yawned and adults reached for another drink, he told how they caught the submarine on the surface near the Carolina coast in early 1942. They holed the conning tower with the first shot, and as they turned for another firing run, their searchlight caught the terrified Germans pouring out of the hatches and leaping into the sea. In the second before the captain could order them to slow to pick up survivors, Lillian's father shouted, "Away depth charges!" The captain was a sucker for a sob story, the old man snickered. Should have seen those Nazi bastards' faces when they saw what I'd done. Screaming, the Germans tried to swim out of the way in the seconds before the depth charges exploded. Then the sea burst around them like boils, killing them all with concussion. The destroyers slowed, and they hauled up the bodies with boat hooks. "Looked like they were sleeping," he always said softly at the end, to create a sense of complicity with his listeners. After being stripped of their uniforms and any body parts that might interest weapons designers, they were buried in an underutilized government cemetery on Nag's Head. I had to listen to that story for 2 weeks every summer for 35 years. When he finally died, I looked forward to the silence as much as to Lillian's inheritance. I was disappointed by both. All the years I served as counsel for the downstate factories, Lillian's brother Tom prowled the Chicago headquarters, insinuating himself into every facet of the business. From file clerk to director, they all owed their jobs to Tom. Not until the old man died did we learn that Tom had recapitalized the company. He inherited all the voting stock. Lillian and her sister Louise were left with non-voting stock that paid a meager dividend and effectively excluded their husbands from management. Along with Louise's husband Harold, I accepted Tom's grinning offer of early retirement. At least the dividend would keep up with Lillian's credit card bills, and I could concentrate on my Civil War stamp collection. Louise and Harold checked into an upscale detox center in West Palm Beach, from which they emerged vowing never to go to the lake again. Instead of a life of quiet detachment, however, Lillian insisted on recreating the family holidays of her childhood, with Tom filling in for her father and his wife Virginia for Louise. They looked like sisters, with the same bony knees, layered blonde hair, and spa-enhanced tans. Tom relished his role, too, always arriving late on the company jet, with breathless news stories of his most recent encounters on the Republican National Committee or the Defense Policy Board. Six-figure contributions gained him easy access to politicians and government purchasing agents, and $1 million earned him and Virginia an invitation to Mar-a-Lago. So now, as the sun sank over Lake Michigan, we heard another bourbon-steeped voice bragging of business coups and newly commissioned projects from the Department of Defense. Instead of stories about dead Germans in the surf, we heard how the administration had savaged the congressional Democrats. In place of the indecisive destroyer captain, we had the Secretary of Defense secretly funding incredible new weapon systems for which Tom's company was the prime and even sole contractor. As the ice melted and the shadows lengthened, I found myself reaching for the bottle again, just as I had when the old man sat in the oversized wicker chair with the moldy cushions. "It's supposed to rain tomorrow," Lillian said as she turned out the bedroom light. "Virginia and I are going to Charlevoix, the shop." "Good," I thought. "Bad roads, too many tourists, thunderstorms. Maybe there'll be an accident." "Will Tom be going?" I asked hopefully. "Weren't you listening when he said he has to fly to Washington for a meeting with Secretary Shanahan?" So if fortune struck, it would only be the two of them. Not perfect, but still not a bad thought to end the day. And Tom would be gone for the weekend. If I had learned anything from Lillian's father, it was that good bourbon could ease the mind. But not that night. The storm came early with a flash through the curtains and a sharp thunder crack. The wind was up, moaning over the bay like drowning men. Before the rain swept in, there was a series of thumps from the water, rhythmic and spaced like a child pounding on blocks. Then the wind suddenly died. I lay in the air conditioning waiting for the storm while Lillian snored beside me. Except for a few more flashes like searchlights sweeping the house, nothing happened. I had to go to the bathroom twice before I could get back to sleep. I was always the first one up. The kitchen faced the road, and while the coffee was brewing, I would walk up to the mailbox for the paper. Then I would pour my coffee, go out to the porch, and sit down in the big wicker chair. As usual, Tom hadn't bothered to put the bourbon away. I was scanning the headlines, hoping for something better than another California murder, when I saw the submarine. It was lying on its side about 100 yards out, gently rocking in the surf, a hole punched in the conning tower. Pieces of black cloth bobbed about it and drifted toward the shore. I opened the screen door for a better look. Those weren't pieces of cloth. Those were bodies, some of them already starting to bloat and splitting the black uniforms. I ran down to the beach. Have you ever seen a dead man in the water newly drowned? Barely out of his teens, his blonde hair floated gently in the little waves, and his eyes were tight shut, as if he had tried to stave off death with darkness. The backs of his fingers brushed the sand. For a moment, I just stood watching the water wash in and out of his hands. His uniform still fit perfectly. The only ornament was an eagle over his heart, clutching a swastika in its talons. I looked out at the wreck again. There was a beautiful red seahorse painted on the conning tower just in front of the hole. Then another body touched the shore, this one not so beautiful. The right arm and shoulder were gone, leaving a deep red opening for minnows to explore. I ran back to the house. Tom was in the kitchen, reading something from his wallet into his cell phone. "Tom," I cried. He shushed me with a gesture. "I've got Jared Kushner on hold," he whispered fiercely. "Yes, that's right," he said into the phone. "Now read the account number back." "Okay, you got it. Thanks." He hit another button. "Jared, sorry. You wouldn't believe what I have to deal with here. Okay, 10:30, on my way." "Tom, I tried to interrupt him. "It's all taken care of," he replied. "I'll call tonight." He was out the door and into the BMW before I could ask what had happened. Was somebody filming a movie and there had been a terrible accident? In 10 minutes, Tom's jet would be over the bay circling south. I went back to the porch. The submarine had heeled completely over on its side, slowly spilling more bodies out of the open hatches. The first ambulance was driving up the beach when Lillian called from the kitchen. "We're going now, dear." How was I going to explain it to them? I went back to the kitchen. "Oh, you needn't have come," she said. "We've decided to have breakfast in town." Normally, that would have been good news. Breakfast was not one of her good meals. "You look terrible," she said. "Is something the matter?" I glanced at Virginia. Her face expressed the horror that her monthly Botox injections could not suppress. Had she looked out their bedroom window and seen what was lying in the surf? "I talked to Tom," I began. "Let's go," Virginia snapped. "I'm hungry." They were gone before I could tell them what Tom had said. I made another pot of coffee and went back to the porch. It was the longest day of my life. All morning, the ambulances drove in along the beach, huge red crosses and white circles on the sides of the brown trucks. I wondered why they didn't use the new Humvees, but they were probably all in Afghanistan. Soldiers and Putes waded into the surf and pulled the bodies to the shore. One by one, they lifted them onto stretchers and loaded them into the ambulances. The tug didn't arrive until mid-afternoon. Men in wetsuits climbed aboard the submarine and secured it with lines to the tugs. Then the boats moved back and forth, white wakes roiling the turquoise water, until they had worked the submarine off the sandbar. Suddenly, the conning tower swung upright, dropping a last body into the lake. Soldiers from the ambulance waded out for it. I saw the boat for the last time when I came back from the kitchen with a glass of ice. As the tugs towed it out into the bay, the ugly gray bow, notched with torpedo tubes, pointed at the shore. Strengthened by the whiskey, I thought maybe it wasn't such a bad thing to depth charge the bastards after all. "You started without us," Lillian said, sweeping onto the porch in a rush of paper bags and gift shop smells. "We've had such a wonderful day, haven't we, Jenny?" "I'm going upstairs to change," Virginia called from the dining room. "We're going to the Busy Bee for dinner, Lillian announced. "Now look what I bought." So I emitted little grunts at Lillian's latest designer acquisitions as the ice melted and the glass turned warm in my hand. By the time the last package was opened, the lake was as vacant as it was every other evening. Even the truck tracks in the sand had disappeared, washed over by the little tide. Then Virginia called from the kitchen that she was ready, and Lillian drove us into town. I was glad I had not had a drink at the house after all. It was better to save my allotment for dinner, when they would recap the day's bargains like hunters recounting a good kill. It was still light when we returned to the house. Lillian and Virginia said they were going to the porch to watch the sunset. "I think I'll take a walk," I said. "Be careful," my wife said without much conviction. "I'm just going along the beach." Instead, I walked along the dunes. For a few moments every day, as the sky lost its color, you could wonder if we really were alone in the universe and whether our dreams were our own. "Hey, buddy," a voice called from a dark space between the dunes. "Is there any place around here a fella can get something to eat?" I was so surprised I could hardly breathe. He stepped up beside me on the dune, a seersucker jacket over his arm. In his early 30s, he had a broad forehead and dark blonde hair combed straight back. Too pale to be a vacationer, he looked like a lawyer from Chicago up for the weekend. "We just had dinner down the road," I said. "Where did you park?" He was as startled as I was when he first called. "I'll have to walk," he said. There was an echo in his voice, as if he had to form each word in his mind before he uttered it. "It's a beautiful evening," he said, looking out at the lake like a bad actor trying to be convincing. I glanced at his feet. I hadn't seen two-toned shoes like that since I was a kid. How about a smoke? He asked, taking a silver cigarette case out of his jacket. I don't smoke, I replied. Well, thanks, buddy, he said, holding out his hand. It was wet with sweat. Do you have any luggage? I asked. I could get the car. No need to trouble yourself, buddy. See you around. He moved quickly back into the dark place. I had never seen anyone so afraid in my life. Lillian had left the kitchen door open and the back porch light off. I was opening the refrigerator for some ice when someone knocked on the screen. Maybe the lawyer had decided to take me up on the ride after all. I turned on the light and went to the door. Two men in double-breasted suits and fedoras were standing under the yellow light. I guess you know why we're here, the bigger one said, holding up a wallet with an FBI badge. I was wondering when somebody would come, I began. Tom said he'd talk to Kushner and would call, but I haven't heard anything. The big man looked at his companion. The smaller man took out a package of Lucky Strikes and offered one to the speaker. Then he lighted their cigarettes with a Zippo. I don't know about any Kushner, the big man said slowly, but I do know we found a raft out on the dunes. Looked like somebody tried to bury it. My chest tightened so much I couldn't speak. The smaller man stepped forward and pointed at me with his cigarette. We figured the submarine came in to land a spy, he said. Just luck that the destroyer caught them. What had I read they did with the German saboteurs they caught during the war? Tried them before military tribunals and electrocuted them the next day with J. Edgar Hoover watching through the sweating glass. Yes, sir, I choked out. Nothing for you to be afraid of, the big man said. Just call our office if you see anything funny. He held out his card. I could be a hero, maybe get an award from the Department of Defense, or I could give a terrified man a few more hours alone. I can find the number in the book, I said. Suit yourself, the big man said. I turned off the porch light and listened to them drive away. Is that you? Lillian called from the porch. I picked up my glass and joined them. They had left the big wicker chair for me. I sat down and poured myself a drink. Tom said he'd call, I began. That's none of your business, Virginia snapped and stalked inside. I just looked at Lillian. You have to be more sensitive, she said. She had a terrible fight with Tom last night about her credit cards. He had to call the bank this morning to straighten it out. I wasn't talking about credit cards. Oh, I'll try to talk to her then. She stood up. But you have to be more sensitive, Walter. So now I am alone on the big family porch as the last Monet colors drain from the sky. Maybe the Department of Defense is experimenting with time travel so our military can outflank the enemy in the fourth dimension. Maybe something went terribly wrong, or Tom told them this was the perfect place for an experiment. But how long do experiments take? What about the FBI and the man on the dunes? If I saw a man on an airplane lighting his shoe, I'd tell someone, I think, but I didn't tell them. If I am prosecuted, I will defend by asking what damage a Nazi saboteur could do 70 years too late. But who could have imagined what a few men with box cutters could do if they took over an airplane? I will say I panicked and didn't know who to call. Could I even get my own lawyer to believe me? I have been too long on this porch. Old houses absorb odors. I smelled Lillian's mother's perfume in the living room last week. Perhaps they absorb memories, too, releasing them when a susceptible person passes through a familiar room. I should go to bed, but Tom did promise to call. I am almost anxious for him to return. Memories of a Family Vacation was published in the Butterfly Collector, Fred McGavran's first short story collection. It may still be possible to find a copy. Our next satire will be, Does Monarda Have a Place in the Mixed Border? a satire of the English aristocracy we have come to know all too well in Upstairs, Downstairs, Downton Abbey, and The Remains of the Day, and all their dreary sequels. Here we are treated to a history of the last few hundred years of the Rockingfords of Rockingford on Quimby, one of the great estates of England, told by Sylph Trillingham Quimby, 18th Lady Rockingford. Sylph rose from being the natural daughter of the 16th Lord Rockingford when all but one of the Rockingfords between her and the coronet died by eating poisoned deviled eggs at a picnic. Until then, goodbye.